Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 17 of Reason Town. I hope that number's right. I'm known for getting the numbers wrong. But I am Murphy Randall, and I'm here with Jared Forsyth today.
Hello.
As we often are together. You've gotten used to our voices because we're your regular hosts. First, we want to say thank you to TylerMcGinnis.com, which is our hosting sponsor. And Tyler is also our friend. He does some great training that is available to you online for the simple price of money. And that didn't make any sense for people. I'm sorry. That was a bad way to say that. In any case, Tyler does training online for web technologies like React and other things as well. I think he even has a Reason course up there. But
that's right. He did a free Reason boot camp a month or so ago.
Do you know if it's recorded?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's available.
Oh, that's great. So go check that out. Thank you so much, Tyler, for sponsoring us. We are fans of your product and of you. And his tagline is the linear course-based approach to learning web technologies. We don't have to read that, but we do because it's a cool thing. Also sponsored by my company, Day One. I love Day One, and thank you for sponsoring. And go check it out if you like to journal. Jared, you want to plug Khan?
Sure. I work for Khan Academy. We're trying to build a free world-class education for anyone, anywhere. And we are hiring. We're looking mostly for senior folks. But we also have a couple of slots for the internship this summer, if you're excited about that.
So what's the age requirement on senior? Like 64 plus?
Right. Senior citizen is, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
So none of us youngsters can go apply. Great. That was a joke also, in case you weren't picking up on that. So today we got some pretty exciting stuff to talk about because it's been a few months since we've been together.
Right.
My wife had another baby since we last spoke, and she didn't have two babies since we last spoke. We had our third baby since we last spoke. So I've been recovering from that, so we haven't done shows, but we're doing okay now, so we're back together. Sorry for the break. But let's get right into talking, Jared, about some pretty cool cutting-edge stuff you're doing with developing Mac applications, native Mac applications in Reason.
Yeah. So one of the things that got me excited about Reason at the very beginning was the promise of being able to compile to JavaScript and to native iOS, native Android, native Mac, Windows, Linux, all of the things. Kind of the write once, run anywhere promise that, you know, Java had back in the day, but then it got crufty, and JavaScript now has, but, you know, it's slow. And so a couple of people in the Reason community have been teasing at the edges, trying to figure out, can we have like a React Native like experience, but cut the JavaScript? And so with the end goal of, you know, compiling to iOS, compiling to Android, an easier target is macOS desktop, because you don't have to mess with cross compilers, but then you still have the, you know, all of the intricacies of interfacing with Objective-C and, you know, trying to get the AppKit GUI to do nice things. And part of my journey was building a game for macOS and, or no, for iOS and Android a year ago.
The Throwing Rocks game?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. The Gravity Space Simulator game was published in the app stores, and then I was messing around with Throwing Rocks. But months went by, and this past year has been really good for the native development story of Reason. Historically, it's been fairly brittle and hard to get started. But there's been a lot of work done on the Dune, used to be called JBuilder, build system, and then the Easy package management system that's bringing things together to make it much, much nicer to get started with.
Now let's pause for a second, because I need to ask you to clarify for me. The native story seems so large and ambiguous. Like, I'm not totally sure what you mean when you say native.
Sure.
Because I know that OCaml native is like, let's write OCaml bytecode with Reason, right?
Uh-huh.
But how do you have access to any kind of iOS libraries? Sorry, let me adjust my mic a little. How do you have access to any macOS libraries, like you said, how do you interact with AppKit and stuff like that? I mean, are you like doing a a transformation from Reason syntax into Swift syntax? Is that kind of thing? Or is it like somehow at the bytecode level, you're writing C that, like, compiling down to C, which can make C calls into these iOS libraries? Like, what's the actual story here? Because native sounds like, it sounds like a magic word when you say, like, hey, we can write native, which means we can write anything. But
right, right. So what that actually amounts to is so OCaml has a C FFI, a foreign function interface.
Okay.
So, and in fact, the external syntax that we have with BuckleScript and JavaScript is actually borrowed from C, from OCaml's interface with C.
Very cool.
And in the normal day-to-day of writing, you know, a Reason program that is compiled to native, anytime you do string concatenation, it's calling a string C function.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're using a web server library, at some point it's talking to C.
Yeah.
And so when doing Reason native GUI, talking to AppKit, I am writing some C functions that, well, actually Objective-C, that are actually, you know, calling the AppKit methods and constructing objects and stuff, and then registering those to be available to the OCaml side.
Okay.
So I can call them from Reason. And a lot of the pain of getting this set up is trying to reconcile the OCaml compiler with the Objective-C, or the OCaml garbage collector, I should say.
Okay.
Where OCaml is garbage collected, and it knows when a function is no longer being used, it can collect it.
Yeah.
And move the memory around. On the Objective-C side, if you're hanging onto a pointer that OCaml has either collected or moved to a different place, bad things happen.
Yeah, totally.
Seg faults, bus errors. I waded through a lot of those.
Okay.
And so there was a lot of trickery involved in trying to figure out what can I depend on OCaml not moving around. And at first I tried to convince OCaml to not move things, and that just didn't go anywhere.
Okay.
But you can register functions on the OCaml side to make them available to C, and say, this is a function and C can call it with an integer. There's no type checking, of course, because it's C. But then you can call it, and OCaml knows this function has to stay around forever. So that was a little bit of weeds, but there was a lot of pain behind it. And so that's what I mean by native Reason development.
Okay, so let's get just a real quick picture of what this actually looks like. If you make an app, like a Mac app, right?
Yeah.
You double-click the icon. Mm-hmm. And, like, a Mac app is made of a manifest file. Like, there's some convention where they say this is how you make an app. And it's like there's a manifest file and an icon and stuff, and you double-click on that, and the manifest file says run this executable. Is that kind of how that works out? And then the executable is an OCaml, like, bytecode bin native code that you've written, right?
Right, yeah. So the executable is in the app directory content/macOS, and then just the Reason native compiled binary.
So that doesn't have to be something that came from Xcode?
No, it doesn't.
Okay.
If you go through Xcode, you get some nicer debugging things, but I want to spend as little time with Xcode as possible.
Okay.
So in OCaml land, I call a function that then goes into Objective-C and does NS application init.
Okay.
And, you know, then we set up the toolbar, and then we create a window. And then once the window is created, I can get an NS view that then my view layout framework can start populating with components.
Okay. So those frameworks are just available because it's Mac. They're
right.
There. Those are C classes that are libraries that are available.
It's
the
compiled with Cocoa, and AppKit and all the things that are on Mac.
So what do you do? Like, when you compile, your OCaml, do you say like link in this library? You can link in some existing library, and it's okay that it's Objective-C because it's just C, or like is it just C? Like is Objective-C just C, or
Objective-C has the same linking characteristics? Well, GCC on a Mac knows how to deal with Objective-C.
Okay. But do you compile OCaml using GCC? You don't, right?
No. But the, and this is where I'm a little out of my depth, but my understanding is there are symbols in a binary, in a library.
Okay.
And the symbols that that Objective-C produces are the same as those that C produces.
Wow.
And so when OCaml compiles down and says, I need these symbols from C for the external functions, it can link them together.
So basically, you compile using OCaml, then you get a bunch of compiled artifacts, then you link them using the normal linker.
Dune takes care of all that.
Oh, okay.
So there's a build system that knows how to bring, actually to compile a C file and just link it in. Which makes my life easier. And then I, in the Dune configuration, I say, also link in the Cocoa framework, also the Core Graphics framework.
Holy cow.
And those are just flags that you would pass to GCC.
Okay. But Dune takes care of it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dune. That's great.
Okay. Yeah.
I added Dune to the show notes, so you remember that. So that helps a lot. Now, you talked about like iOS, et cetera. That sounds like it gets a lot harder on iOS because you don't have the freedom just to say, here's any executable, right? Or do you?
It is a little bit more tricky because you have to keep in mind whether it's a dynamically linked or statically linked library. But for iOS compilation, when I was making the game, I turned the OCaml code into a shared library and then brought that into Xcode.
Okay, so there's still some like Xcode thing that is the entry point that says call out to the library that you've made.
Right, which is acting like a C library. Yeah. So Xcode doesn't know any different.
Okay, great. Wow, that's really interesting. That's amazing. Okay, so I thank you for the time off in the weeds. That was really helpful to me, hopefully to listeners too. So let's continue on with the story that you were telling about your adventure on Mac desktop and also how the community has evolved in the last 4 months. You said there's the ecosystem for this is better.
So I was dinking around with making an alternative UI framework that would be able to compile to JavaScript and also to native and would act like React. So use JSX and have hooks actually and all these fun things.
Ooh.
And at the same time, some other people had been working on a library called Brisk for actually a year or more with the goal of kind of having a similar thing but focused on compiling to iOS. And then several months ago, Brian Phelps, who created the Oni IDE, which is an Electron GUI over a real Vim backend.
Yeah.
Which has been around for a couple of years and is really cool.
It's kind of like lot of early development, pretty small adoption right now, but still very cool.
But has some really nice IDE features that you might miss if you're just in Vim normally. So the creator of that was looking around for a way to get off of Electron and kind of the performance problems with Electron and the size issues and landed on Reason and started making his own React-like compile to native UI framework.
React is everywhere.
It's everywhere. And so the thing that Brian created is called Reverie, and it's been making a splash in the past several weeks. It compiles to it targets OpenGL and WebGL, so it doesn't use native components, whereas the thing that I've built, which is called Fluid and Brisk, target native components. And so a month or two ago, I wanted to try out my framework, and I created a little emoji picker called Qmoji, and I was just looking around for some status bar application written in Electron that I could then rewrite in Reason and have a much smaller binary.
And steal market share from.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it hadn't seen any development in the past year or so, so I figured the maintainers wouldn't be too mad at me.
Okay, good.
But the difference was really nice. I created the app full feature clone with, you know, some design tweaks, but the binary that came out, I think, was 6 megabytes.
I thought it was less than that. I thought it was like 2.3 megabytes or something.
It was 2.3 megabytes before I added like the logo.
Oh,
asset.
Okay.
So the images are larger than the binary. But the original Electron based application was like 120 megabytes.
Yeah. Yes.
And so it really, that was gratifying to see, you know, Reason Native can create, you know, a compelling workable, application.
And it's fast.
And it's fast.
I just checked it out. 3.4 megabytes.
Okay.
With the logo.
That's right. And anyway, so that was a fun proof of concept that I still use every day because I like it a lot better than the built-in Mac one.
Yeah, so actually that's funny because I also use it. I like it better than the built-in Mac one, but whenever I show it to people, they're like, "What? You know you can just do command control space, right?" And I'm like, "Yeah, but there's an animation when you do that."
Yeah, it takes so long.
It takes like a second to get it
open. Also, it's not keyboard navigable. You've got to like, anyway.
You can't use arrow keys on it?
No, I think you have to tab in order to select the main thing and then you can use arrow keys.
Okay. Usually. Well, yeah. So it's really fast inside of this to just search
and
tab and enter.
Anyway. So I built a native Mac app, which was super fun. I'm still experimenting with the Fluid, UI framework. I'm not sure if I'm going to release it to the world. I mean, it's open source, so you can look at it, but it doesn't have great documentation or anything. It's possible that I'll just fold the ideas that I've explored into Brisk or Reverie. But yeah, that's kind of the story of the past several months.
Wow, that is fun. That's cool that you were able to do that. And so talk a little bit about Reverie is something that you would use if you're going to do your own graphical user interface, essentially, right? Because I'm looking at the components that exist for it. It looks like there's some stuff that does exist, sliders and borders and buttons, but it really looks like extremely bare bones, no frills rendering.
Yeah, it certainly doesn't have the polish that you'd expect from native components yet. I understand that their goal is kind of do the same thing that Flutter is doing.
Oh, okay.
Which is a very hard thing.
Like it's hard.
It's very hard to make a full UI component system.
Copy the entire design feel and then you have to react and change it as soon as it's changed.
Right. I don't think they're necessarily wanting to copy like iOS and Android and Mac.
Maybe do their own thing.
Because Flutter really is trying to be pixel for pixel, which I think is just absolutely...
Extremely difficult.
But... Yeah, so they're building a custom GL-based interface, which means that it renders exactly the same to JavaScript or to native.
Which is cool.
Which is very cool. But then Brisk is using AppKit and so is Fluid.
So right now, if you were going to say, now is my time, I'm trying to write my app, I want to do this. First of all, you'd be in for some adventure because this is still the bleeding edge, right?
Yeah.
Second of all, as far as choices between the two, if you're going to go with Reverie, you're going to end up having to write your own like renderers to get some good looking stuff. I don't actually know how that works. Would you write your own OpenGL shaders to make buttons, etc.? Like,
yeah, it would probably be a lot of work.
Okay.
Or you could just be satisfied with crappy looking buttons.
That's what they have.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you know,
that'll do the job.
Function precedes form.
Right.
Form follows function, something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that does look really cool. So maybe your choice wouldn't be Reverie if you're looking at making something beautiful right now.
No, yeah, not right now. I mean, it's still early days. They've got some cool demos.
Yeah, very cool. Okay. And that's kind of what the express statement is, like, this is in development.
We're
trying to get this going.
We want this to become a thing, and there are a lot of moving parts to bring together. And the Reverie folks have done an incredible job.
And it looks like Brisk is as well, same thing, same kind of state of early development. and not a lot of documentation or anything at this point. Still very cool. So I wonder what's going to happen as we watch these things move forward and how, what kind of energy they'll maintain.
Yeah.
And fluid. But like you said, future undetermined of that.
That's right.
So what are your takeaways? Are you going to be writing a lot of Mac apps with this?
I've written 3 so far. So there's Qmoji, which is released, and then there's one. It's another status bar app that I'm using to keep track of my open pull requests for work.
Cool.
We use Fabricator instead of GitHub. So there are revisions, and it helps me keep track of how many. It lets me know how many things I have that are accepted and ready to land, and how many code review requests I have that I should look at.
Cool.
And so I don't have to go, you know, open up the website every half hour and check to make sure I'm not keeping anybody waiting or whatever it is.
Okay.
So it's nice and unobtrusive. And then the third one is a disk usage analyzer. Just because I am ornery and don't want to use any of the ones that are out there. But basically I wanted the DU command.
Yeah.
I wanted a GUI for that.
Okay.
Because you know, it's built in and it'll do all the things. I just wanted like a tree view, so I could dig down and then maybe, and then you can also select things and add them to a list that you can then copy an RMRF.
Okay. That's cool.
So it's very bare bones, but it was fun to hook up the AppKit like column view thing and see what it's like to hook up something that has so many callbacks, because it uses an interface that it calls a function for every cell to say, what should I render here?
Okay.
And is this a leaf node? And all these things. So hooking that up and making it performant, because calls across the bridge are certainly much cheaper than, you know, going to JavaScript or something like that. But there's still a cost. There's either still a cost or my reason code was slow.
Okay.
Which is possible, because I was looking up in a hash map and doing a variety of things. But then I added caching on the Objective-C side to say, if I haven't changed the props, there's no way for me to change what this thing is returning unless I have a random generator, which is dumb anyway.
Yeah.
And then it became really fast. So that's the third app I've done. Now I'm focusing more on a Reason React app that I'm working on. But I'll probably swing back around to Mac development in the next little bit.
So this isn't the kind of thing that if I've never written a Mac app before, I should just like go check out. Go check out Fluid and be like, hey, I'm going to write a Mac app now, because I probably need to know some Objective-C or probably need to know about the frameworks. Unless, is it that simple? I mean, could I just download it and be like, let's get going on this and make an app?
It depends on what components you want. If you don't want any components that I haven't, or if all you want is stuff that I've already bridged,
yeah,
then I like to think that it actually wouldn't be too bad.
Okay.
So, I mean, there are buttons, there are text areas, there's actually a canvas widget where you can draw to.
Okay.
So for Qmoji, this was another performance interesting thing. First, I had each emoji in its own view.
Yeah.
And there are like 1,500 of them.
Okay.
And of course, any Mac or iOS developer will tell you, you don't put 1,500 views on the screen. That's never going to be performant.
Yes.
And so once I realized that, I switched over to making a custom view that will allow you to just draw text or draw squares and detect mouse events. So it's essentially like using the DOM canvas. And so that's how I render the list of emojis.
So what, how do you draw an emoji? Is like, are they images or what?
It's drawing text, and you just put,
oh, cool. Right? Okay. Yeah.
You know, with the system default font at a certain font size.
And then when you tab through them, you're drawing a box. Like, you know, in memory, which ones are highlighted.
I draw a rectangle around it.
Oh, that's cool. So if I wanted to do like a grid of images, that's already supported with your framework.
Yeah, I have image loading and suspense, kind of.
What?
It's buggy, but as long as you're using it only in the way that I use it.
Okay.
So there's image drawing, there's buttons, there's text. If that's all you need, then I think it would be pretty easy to do.
Pretty cool.
If you're writing, you know, a large thing or anything complicated, I'm sure you'll need more than that.
Well, one of the things that I've enjoyed that I bought for $2 was a UTC clock in the system bar. So when I'm checking server logs, so if anyone wants to make an open source clone that's 2 megabytes of the UTC clock, I'd be happy with that too. So.
Yeah, I think that would probably take, it would take me probably 15 minutes and someone new to it, probably not more than an hour or two.
That's cool. Well, maybe I should do that as a hack project someday.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anything more on the Mac topic before we move on?
No, let's move on to the server side.
Server side. This is the continuing story of the reason on the server. That's a reference to the Muppet Show, in case you haven't seen that. Okay, so I'm still doing server-side stuff. We're still rocking it. Things are getting to be a nicer experience now. So let me talk to you a little bit about some of the stuff I've done recently. So you were with me through previous episodes where I talked about this whole kind of like, what do I do with errors? Like, how do I handle errors? Because
that's right.
If I throw an OCaml exception, that's completely undebuggable because there's no stack trace, you know, unless you make a unique exception for everything and know exactly where it's going to be.
Mm-hmm. And even then, how do you know how, like, what are the stack traces can only get you so far because you don't know the data that's coming along.
Yeah. So I guess you could make really rich exceptions that contain all the data and, you know, the place where they're going to be thrown and stuff. That's not the choice. That's not the path I chose to follow.
Yeah.
So I instead chose to follow kind of more the error as data kind of path.
Okay.
And so my server was written all with this concept of like the breadcrumbs thing that I had done.
Right.
Where you could, like, I was trying to keep a trail of strings of like where I had been, and so that if I failed, I could just say like, here's everything I did.
Well, and the other problem here was that this was a lot of asynchronous code, right?
Yes.
So the JavaScript stack trace gave you nothing.
Nothing.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, like, when JavaScript throws an error, it was more or less okay sometimes, because at least I knew like it happened in this file and I could sometimes get to that. But yes, the async plus especially the OCaml exceptions was a nightmare. So I had all this old code, and then I spent a good amount of time experimenting with promise implementations, like promise alternatives libraries, which I'll talk about for a second, and ended up, of course, writing my own. I was hoping not to do that, but I did, and I'm happy with how it turned out, and I'll explain why. And I called that POM or pomegranate, because we got to be punny here because it's like promises. And I wanted to release it, but I haven't released it because I've got a lot of stuff to do, but I did drop the source in the show notes. So if you're interested, go look it up. But here's the idea around a POM. So there are lots of JavaScript promise wrappers and alternatives that are out there right now.
Like, okay.
One is called Vow, and there are others that are very impressive, very cool. None of them did exactly what I had hoped for. A lot of them were concerned with making promises sound in reason so they don't break the type system. Like, they were very concerned with making it. Let me explain what that means to the listeners who may not know what that means. So if your library is unsound, that means it breaks the type system in some certain edge cases. So in some certain edge cases, the way you use the library may make it so that the type system is no longer true.
Right, and to break the type system means to make invalid the promises that the type system makes, right?
Correct.
Because ideally, if you have a good type system and it allows your program to compile, the type system is promising you will not have a type error.
Correct. The program should work, right? And especially at the place in the code where you said you should have an integer, you will have an integer.
Right.
So specifically with promises, the problem with the underlying implementation of JavaScript promises that makes them quote-unquote untypable is that if you have a promise of a promise, they get folded down and collapsed into a single promise. Right. There's an automatic flat map that happens on a promise. So if you say I'm inside of a promise already, I'm going to return a new promise. There's no concept of higher order promise retention in JavaScript. It's like, why would you ever want to do that? Is what they say. And I kind of agree with them. Why would you ever want to do that?
And this is why in an async function, returning a value and returning await that value is exactly the same.
Correct.
Unless you're inside a try-catch.
Are those different?
Yeah.
Okay.
Awaiting the promise before returning or just returning the promise have the exact same effect because it'll collapse the promise anyway.
Exactly right. So that, as an underlying implementation for promises, makes promises unsound and untypable. That sounds so extreme to say, but they can't be completely soundly typed in Reason. Because if you are inside of a function that returns a promise and you return a promise of something else, your type system says that you have a promise of integer, for example. Right?
Right.
So at runtime, what you would really have is a promise of integer. So your type system is now unsound. It's untrue, right?
Right.
I decided I don't really care about this. A lot of people are very concerned with this. This is not something that I run into. I never return a promise of a promise. On purpose. Like, there's never a place in my code where I have said, I really need a nested promise here.
Right.
I was just not concerned with that. What I was concerned with was a really nice API around controlling how promises failed.
Okay.
And treating failures as data. Because the normal promise implementation says, I'm going to focus on the happy path. Here's a promise of an integer. And if it fails, you get an error of some sort, which could be any object, but probably has a stack trace on it and maybe a message. You know, it's like the Wild West, right? And so the way OCaml has wrapped that is that there's this JS exception object, and it's opaque. You can log it. You can throw it. That's about it. You know?
Right.
It's just like, oh, we have no idea what to do here. And I wanted more than that. I wanted to be able to handle this. Because part of the distinction I was making earlier was, as a programmer, if you're dealing with something that can fail, you want to know, can the user do something to recover from this error? If so, I need to propagate information about the error back to where the user can see it. So that's where you need to be able to have actual typed information in the failure path. If the user cannot do anything to resolve this error, and it's something that the programmer needs to be able to do to resolve it, then I need to log a detailed log, and then my failure type becomes unit. I don't return anything.
Mm.
There is no. All I need to know is that there was a failure, and I don't need to propagate any information about it.
Right.
So I wrote this POM library to do explicitly this and give you a nice API around it. So this POM has a low level type, which is a POM with error, and it can either be a success of some type or a failure of another type.
Okay.
So it's got a left and a right hand side. This will be very familiar to people who have used Elm or Haskell and have the either type result type. They're all kind of siblings, right? But we stopped the recording for a second. The main type you're going to use when you're using a POM is just POM of something. So that's a type alias. And the type alias for just POM is that on the left side you have data and on the right side you have unit.
Okay.
So it's saying that it's making the assumption, this is kind of like, I guess, a Rails-ish configuration, like convention over configuration, but it's making the assumption that most of the time when you have something that's going to fail, you just want to propagate the fact that it failed, and you're going to log out the fact that it failed, and that's all you need to know. Because most of the errors that happen in a web application, the user cannot do anything about.
Right.
So that's most of your types are a POM, and they're designed to work that way. So you have map, you have flat map, you have all like promise POM.all to be able to do a list of POMs all together.
Sure.
And then the underlying type has this error type, which is most usually unit. Now this has some really interesting properties because now if you're making a library that uses POMs that your application is going to use, for example, my database library that I made returns with a POM.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't return with POM of unit. It returns with POM of error, and that error type is specific to the database.
Okay.
So it can return, like, the shape of the error that the database is going to return, like, oh, here's the information about your query and why it failed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is if you're inside of a function that returns a POM, like a promise, right, and so you do some stuff, and then you make a database call. And what you're going to do is you're going to flat map on that database call, assuming you want to make more than one, or you're going to map it. And let's say you start, you're going to return a POM of unit, or I'm sorry, you're going to return a POM of some information, and the error type should be unit.
Right.
So what happens is you make that database call, all of a sudden your types don't match up anymore.
Right.
Because your database has the information, and then the error type is not unit.
Right.
So the type system forces you to handle this error.
Okay.
Which is cool. So what you do is you map error. And almost always what you do is out in the place where you actually know what you're doing. Let's say this is like the fetch my puppies endpoint or something, right? And you're making a call to the database to get your puppies out of it. So you make this database call and it comes back. And right there, you're going to be able to say like log.error2. And it just curries it. So you just pass in log.error to some string about what you were trying to do, like failed while trying to fetch puppies from the endpoint. And okay. Then the error gets passed in. And now you've mapped over the error. And now all of your types line up again. So your database call just prints out the error if there's a problem. And then that turns it into a POM with the unit on the error side again. And now all your stuff like clicks into place like Legos.
Okay. So the place where you get a POM that has an actual error type, you get to decide, this is unrecoverable, I'm going to add a message about why, and it will log and then give me back a normal unit error POM.
Precisely, yeah.
Okay.
So what's really cool about this is that we can, if we build our whole application on top of this, then down at the handler level, Express, is as much as my web framework that I'm using right now, the wrapper around Express expects a POM. So it knows that if a promise of unit comes down the line, or a promise with an error of unit comes down the line, then it's just going to return a 500 when that error message appears, right? Or that error path happens. That's a better way to say it.
And it's already been logged because you know it's unrecoverable.
Exactly right.
That is cool.
But if the error message actually has context, what you can do is you say like my handler here that I like. The code for my handler actually accepts a POM that can either succeed with an express response or it can fail with an express response. So you know that on either path, at some point you're going to either, you know, like you can either say like this endpoint is never going to return something to the user that they can do something about. Maybe you know that. So in that point you say like my handler is just going to expect a POM. If there's any failure, then I'm going to return a 500. Or you can say, like, this is a handler that can fail with information for the user, and it's going to expect an express response in the happy path or an express response in the failure path, where we can give the user specific information about what failed. And that usually happens in the middleware, where you would do something like that.
Is there a way to... So when you were describing this, I was expecting that the type would have three constructors.
Okay.
That there would be a success, an unrecoverable error, and then an error with data.
Okay.
Such that you would be able to express both, like, oh, this should be a 400, and here's the information about it, or this is unrecoverable, just bail.
So that's expressible in the more abstract way. So that's where, like, so here's where we're gonna get into the handler layer. And I wrote a handler layer around Express. So there's BS Express, which is pretty bare bones and low level. Mm-hmm. That's like Express typed. That's not like how you would do Express if you had reason from the start.
Right? This is not an opinionated wrapper.
Yeah, or like it's just a useful across. Wrapper for a type system, right? I mean, like that's not what I mean to say, because it's a great wrapper, but it doesn't take advantage of the type system to make it like a pleasing experience to write web apps. So I wrote a layer on top of that, and I just called it handler.re, and I put it up on, it's in the show notes if you go look at the link there too. But basically what that does is that turns POMs into handlers. And so you basically have some functions for POM composition that take in a request and a response and are expected to return a POM of, depending on your situation, either a POM without an error or a POM with an error.
Okay.
And if it returns, if it's a POM with an error, then it's the error type is an express response. So that's where you would say, if it's an unrecoverable error, then it's a POM of unit. And we know to just throw a 500 to the user back.
Yeah.
But if it's a POM with an error, there's a different handler function for that. And that's where I'm telling the handler library, I'll take care of the error part here. So like in this case, this would be like, I'm authenticating the user.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find their user in the database. Or actually, that's not the right one. Maybe like, I'm authenticating the user. I'm parsing the body for the request. I can't find their password in the body. So I don't want to just throw a 500. I want to return a 400 and say,
right,
this was a bad request. I need a password.
You know, okay. So when you're writing the REST endpoint, do you have to decide at the part where you do the handler whether there will be more errors than just 500?
You have to decide whether it's recoverable or not.
Okay.
So as soon as you run into a case in the code where you need to actually inform the user of some error that they can recover from, that's where you have to change your type.
Gotcha. Cool.
Which turns out to be, like, I'm surprised how rarely that happens, because most of the time when the user can do something about the error, that happens in the middleware. So let's talk about the middleware for a second.
Okay.
Because this handler library actually replaces Express middleware, because this takes typed functions and provides some compositional glue to be able to glue typed functions together and get type-safe middleware. So you can say, like, here's a function that parses this thing from the body, and either it's going to return an error to the user or it'll continue on to the next handler, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the way Express does this is it expects you to just do something in the middleware and then stick something on the request body, mutate it,
right,
and then say, go, next middleware, go. And then everyone just assumes that the data they're going to need is on the request body.
Right.
Totally not type safe, totally not the reason way to do things. So what this does instead is this is actually passing type safe user data through the function arguments as POMs, as async POMs. So basically what you can do is it's expecting you to start with like a function that takes a request and a response and returns like A, some type.
Okay.
Maybe I should say X. That's a better way to say it on the podcast. So it takes request and response and returns X. And then ultimately, you need some function that like takes X and returns an Express response.
Right.
So you can have as many steps in there as you want, where you go from A to B and B to C and C to D. And then as long as you return an Express response in the end, we're good. So this provides the code to just compose those and glue them together. It's turned out to be really pretty elegant. Too. So that's all based on POMs, and that's made possible by this ability to say, as a first class concept, I know when I'm going to succeed or I'm going to fail.
Uh-huh.
And in practice, this has actually been really good for debugging, because it's allowed us to remember to actually log detailed stuff that when something fails, we can go back and figure out why it was going wrong and what we need to do about it.
I like that.
Pretty cool. And that's been... It has not at all been onerous to use in the code either,
yeah,
especially if you're using infix functions. Like we adopted some of the ugly Haskell infix operators. You might say ugly, you might say beautiful. They're understandable if you know what they mean.
Right.
Not great for people who are just coming into the code, but basically like you make a database call, and what's even cooler is we also have support for let anywhere, which is your library
let
for
anything. Yeah.
Let anything. Thank you. Which is also your library for syntax transformation to make continuations a little easier to use.
Right.
So we support that. So you do like let percent pom, and then you make some async call, and right on the back of the async call, you can just do the map error right there.
Cool.
to log the error, and then you've got your value, you've got your happy path, and it's almost like writing in normal JavaScript and mostly focusing on the happy path.
Cool.
But you have really detailed logging, which is cool.
Yeah. And that's solved a problem that I've had, or I think that will probably solve a problem that I've had when using errors as data, where when I say the error happens, you know, 10 levels deep, but since I'm in the mode of using errors as data, I just pass it up the chain, and then 2 levels deep, I decide, oh, this is unrecoverable, I will log it out now. But then I don't have the stack trace from where it actually happened.
Yes,
and I
exactly.
don't have the additional information. So I'll have to look at POM and see if it works for me.
I mean, you can definitely still propagate it up the chain, but this encourages you not to, because that gets painful. Like,
right.
You want to resolve it as soon as you can. Sometimes it's tempting to resolve it too deep, because if you just make your database library log as soon as there's a database error, then you may not know what context that was in, you know?
Right, right. And some of those are recoverable. So, or, you know, is useful information to the program.
Here's what's actually pretty cool, though, too, is that using this pattern, you can actually make your own stack trace. So let's say you did make it so that the database library always returns, always just logs and never lets you look at the error as data.
Mm-hmm.
That may be hard to debug in the log because you always just see database error, blah. And you're like, there are 1,000 places to make a call to the database. But what you can do is, so the caller who called that, it's going to receive the fact that that failed. So it's going to be a POM of unit on the error side.
Mm-hmm.
So a POM of a comma unit. But you can actually map that again, and you can add another error message.
And oh, and say, you can log out and say, I just got this and it wasn't there.
Yeah. So you can say, even though it returns a POM of unit, you can say, I'm going to also log here too. So you can have the database logs itself. And then in the puppies endpoint, you could say like, oh, I was trying to get the puppies, but they failed. And then outside of there, you can be like, actually, this wasn't the endpoint. This is the cat's endpoint calling the puppies endpoint that failed, you know? And so all of a sudden you get your own stack trace that's actually meaningful that says that supports async, that actually shows the path of where you were backing out from when this error happened.
Fascinating.
I don't know. That takes some discipline to do because the type system doesn't make you do it. That's why I kind of like the, if you're like a core library, just return the error. But if your application code, handle it as soon as you can
mm-hmm.
and give some detailed logging, that seems to work pretty well.
Well, of course, now I'm thinking about a PPX that would automatically attach file and line information.
Oh, that would be cool.
If you're unwrapping. Anyway.
Yeah, that would be way cool.
Yeah.
You could automatically, like, I don't even know how you would do that. But
it would probably look at any time you have let %POM, it would just add a, you know, map error with a log.
Underscore location.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be cool because then you would have like an actually useful async stack
right,
trace.
Right. It could track that all the way.
It could make them way better than JavaScript async stack traces, which is cool too. Yeah, that's pretty cool. So there's that. So there's the logging library.
Okay. So that was POMs and that was handlers.
Yeah, not the logging library. That's what's coming next. Yeah.
Okay.
So POMs and handlers. So that took a lot of hours of research and a lot of hours of refactoring. But it worked. And that was another thing I loved about the recent experience is like I completely changed the core async abstraction
mm-hmm.
and I spent hours rewriting the code, but it worked in the end after. Actually, it didn't because sometimes like it took me a couple iterations and
uh-huh.
sometimes my wrapping code was wrong. And so I got runtime errors and that was really hard to debug.
Oh, yeah.
But when you wrapped it right, then it's really cool.
And it comes together.
I actually initially tried it with reactive streams, but I ran into some serious problems with the fact that you can't represent values over time in the type system. Like I couldn't distinguish between this is a stream of X, like a stream of one X or a stream of zero X's or a stream of more than one X. Like those are important semantically in reactive stream libraries and they are irrepresentable as far as I could tell in the type system.
Oh, because reason doesn't have higher counted types.
That is more smart than I am. I couldn't think of how we would represent that, but
where you want a type that is this kind of stream and you want a type that is another kind of stream, but you want operators that work on both types.
Yes. Right.
And it's hard for a reason to do that.
Yeah. And it would get really messy. I think even if you had higher kind of types, that would take a lot of mental power, I think, to understand. Maybe I'm wrong though.
I often find that reactive streams require more mental power than I'm willing to give.
Yeah, that's what I found too. So I like using stream libraries, very cool. I opted to move away from them when I was initially experimenting because of that problem, because I found that there was a whole lot of mental burden around distinguishing when there were zero values, one value, or more than one value. And there were runtime semantics and errors around that, like some serious bugs that happened because of that.
Yeah.
Sorry, didn't mean to talk about that one. All right, so let's talk quickly about Datadog, which is a service that costs a lot of money, but we started paying for and has been very valuable.
Okay. What does it do?
It's application performance metrics, log collection, and metrics, custom metrics. So
okay.
Those are the kind of things like visibility is extremely important for actual like server uptime and like delivering value to your customers.
Gotcha. So this isn't customer analytics. You know, how many times did people click buy?
Correct.
It is.
This is like
how long did it take to load the site?
Yes.
Okay.
Or like, somebody made a request to get their user profile and it didn't return for 60 seconds. Why? And,
right.
And so Datadog already
can it tell you why?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is pretty amazing. So Datadog has done a lot of work already to support some existing standard libraries and things. So they already have integrations that work with Express, for example. So you just like install the Datadog library, get it running first. It's like the first thing you import, by the way, which I couldn't do in Reason, by the way, because you can't dictate import order.
Oh, sure.
I had to do a JavaScript file that imported my Reason files. So they'll bootstrap a bunch of stuff. They'll monkey patch and duck punch libraries and do a bunch of dangerous stuff. But
I hadn't heard of duck punching.
I think that's another name for monkey patching. But
okay.
That's what I heard from my Ruby days.
Wow.
But they do this, and then they start sending performance metrics to the server, and they know what Express is and what those requests are. So they'll show you like, hey, this request took a whole long time. They even have some machine learning going on where they say, we noticed an anomaly.
Oh,
this
for sure.
Endpoint usually takes 2 seconds. It took 60, and they'll point it out to you. So then you can go inside, and they've graphed a graphical representation around the Open Tracing standard. Open Tracing standard is a way of saying, like, here's what my app is doing across microservices, right? So you can actually go in and using bars, like a Gantt chart, basically, they'll show you, here's the total duration of your request, and then here are the things that happen inside your request. So you can see that a lot of stuff was like CPU time, because they'll show you, like, you can instrument things to report their blocks of time.
Mm-hmm.
By default, CPU operations are not instrumented, so you wouldn't see like
so it
a block
doesn't slow
that says,
down your individual function calls.
Yeah, or like, you know, they don't even know how to say like you spent this much time parsing the body. You
right.
Know? Like
right.
They're just not gonna put that in there. So you can do that though by hand. Like if you,
sure.
It's pretty easy to say I'm gonna instrument this block now.
Sure.
So, but they do instrument async, like HTTP calls.
Okay.
By default, and they also have wrappers for. Node Postgres, so a lot of normal database libraries are
cool.
Like Redis or Mongo. So I was able to jump in and see like, my endpoint is taking a long time. Wow, I'm making like 53 calls to S3 in this endpoint, and they're stacking. And
right.
I can see that they're happening in bunches, which I was confused by and then realized it was actually exactly how I programmed it and it was okay. But, you know, I was able to get a graphical representation of what my function was doing in the endpoint.
Cool.
Which all the people who use, you know, tools like Python are like, well, duh, that's normal, like, graphing of what's going on. Well, that's not really a super common thing, I think, in JavaScript, but especially not in Reason.
Right.
So that was a really cool experience, and a lot of that worked out of the box. I had to do custom instrumentation to get GraphQL working.
Okay.
Where I, like, they just said, oh, this is just an HTTP request, because they didn't know the GraphQL library. But then I said, no, this is actually, like, I'm going to say it's a GraphQL request, and I'm going to also include the whole GraphQL request in the metadata so I can see what was going on.
So you can see the query.
Yeah, without the variables, right?
Right.
So you strip out the variables so that there's not private stuff in there, but you can see, oh, like, this was my whole GraphQL query. Same thing with Postgres. They'll automatically include your whole SQL query so you know
cool.
Exactly what was going on. So Datadog is super cool. They also do logging, log collection, and log parsing.
Okay.
Like many other services do as well, but theirs is pretty well integrated to the point where when you're in these traces of like what happened in this request, you can also say, show me the logs for this request.
Uh-huh.
And that'll work. Doesn't work out of the box with JavaScript. So here's where I had to get a little bit funky, because you have to include a trace ID with each request. So,
oh, sure. So that they can match it with which request it came from.
Exactly right. Yeah. And, so I started using this logging library called Pino, which is really cool. It's a JavaScript logging library. They're really focused on performance, so it's very performant. I'm not so worried about the performance of the logging. Some people might be. What I liked more was that they really care about JSON formatting by default. They stick out a JSON object that has all your information in it for every log. And Datadog automatically understands JSON.
Sure.
So you can just like go into the JSON object and say, oh, this like request dot request time just right click it and say, like, this is a metric that I want to track, and then they'll start indexing it. And that is so much easier than writing a custom log parser function to try to teach the tool how to understand your log. It's like super cool. So Pinot is sweet for logging, but I had to figure out how to get the trace ID on there.
Yeah.
And so my goal was, I want to make it, even though this is completely impure as far as pure programming goes, I wanted to make it so that anywhere I log inside of my handlers, I automatically get the trace ID attached to that log without thinking about it. Like, that is a global side effect. I want that to happen. That's expressly a place where I think that should go. So I actually wrote a wrapper for Pinot. And what I needed to do is I needed to get off of some global state somewhere what request was currently happening.
Yeah.
This gets really tricky in Node, for those who don't know, because Node's as a server is single threaded. There are a lot of servers who dedicate one thread to one request. A lot of the servers have a hard time scaling because threads are pretty expensive to maintain, and especially keeping around data local to a thread. You know, maybe that's not expensive, but I think that for Java and for Ruby that have, you know, one request per thread, I think that a lot of your time ends up going to, like, the CPU scheduling those threads and trading off between them.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow Node is able to make it a lot faster by saying, I have an event loop, I have one thread, I'm going to take care of switching myself and, like, do everything async and not spend any time, like, any time that I'm waiting on I/O, I'm going to be handing off to other CPU operations. That helps things a lot to go way faster. So that's why Node is pretty cool. It's like, you know, if you have Node versus Ruby, probably Node is going to do things faster by default because it's async a lot.
But then you don't have thread local variables.
Exactly. You don't have a thread for your request. So it's hard to say, hey, everyone, during this request, this user is the active user, because all of the threads are in the same memory space. I'm sorry, all of the requests are in the same memory space.
Right.
So how do you handle this when all of your async callbacks are interwoven? Well, people have wondered about this and come up with different approaches, but the approach that Datadog used to track the APM stuff, I looked inside their source code because Datadog has open source libraries, which is cool.
Nice.
Is the library that I mentioned a number of episodes ago, which is based on Node's experimental proposal for async hooks.
Gotcha.
Does that sound right? Or is hooks is a buzzword right now because of React?
Sure.
Async hooks meaning I believe that you can actually hook into the lifecycle events of functions of child functions inside of Node. I think those are the details.
Okay.
So you could say, like, hey, when a function who is a child of me, when a function inside of my function gets called, I want to know that, and before it runs, I'm going to mutate some memory.
Right.
Right? Which can get nasty, but it can also get awesome.
Okay.
Because there are libraries, particularly the one I am using is called CLS for continuation local storage. A continuation, for those who don't know as well, is like a function that is going to call another function and pass some data along inside of itself. And that's Express is based all around continuations.
Right.
So CLS-hooked. So it's continuation local storage using Node's hooked API is what that means. Now, it gets tricky. This is not like a one-size-fits-all solution because your async library has to be has to use Node's functions so that these callbacks actually work.
So it can't call some other C function that does async in a different way?
Right.
Okay.
And so, for example, well, not even just C, but like Q promises like Q.js or Bluebird promises, these things are not instrumented to expose this information.
Okay, so set timeout doesn't do it for you.
Set timeout, let me think.
Because I imagine they do it with set timeout or set immediate or something.
I wouldn't know the details, but I know that those libraries,
there's a little bit more work you have to do.
They'll lose your context, and you have to instrument it by hand to wrap those things.
Okay.
So this has killed this as a default solution for a lot of people. Like, for example, Loopback, the enterprise level Node framework, tried to use this approach for its local storage stuff, its thread local storage, but people were losing their context all the time with whatever weird libraries they were using.
Gotcha.
So there was, understanding that risk, I went ahead and tried it in my application. Turns out I'm using Palms, which just used node promises, so everything just worked.
Okay.
Which is a big relief, right?
Cool.
So basically, cool thing is the Datadog framework automatically extracts the trace ID and puts it in a global context. Uh-huh. So I thought, well, this is great. I'll just like stick that on all my logs, and then I'll stick that on the request log at the end. And then I'll have every log will have a trace ID, which almost worked. Every log except for the access log that I'm using for Express had the request ID.
Hmm.
So the access log at the end didn't. And this is because the way Express does middleware is that the first middleware registered is also the first middleware to end itself, because it just uses event listeners request object. So Datadog is the first middleware to register itself to say, I'm going to set up this whole request context. It's also the first one to lose that context. And then all of the other middleware that were registered afterward, like the access logger for Express, they don't have that context anymore.
Gotcha.
Which made me sad. Yeah. So what I had to do was I had to write a custom middleware. This is, it gets tricky, but I had to write a custom middleware that ran after Datadog that would call my logging middleware inside of itself to make sure that the context was still around. But basically, that just said, like, I'm going to get the trace ID off of Datadog. I'm going to put it on my own context, and then I'll make sure this context stays around until the request logging happens.
Gotcha. Okay.
So if you were like using Koa.js, I don't think this would be a problem, because Koa uses generators. It yields control to the inner middleware, and then it steps out in the same order that it stepped in.
Right.
So the first middleware to register is also the last middleware to end, which is, I like that. But since we're using Express, we ended up with this hacky thing. It worked, though.
Okay.
And then the other thing I did that ended up being incredibly cool was put the when a user authenticated, I put the user's user ID onto the global context as well. So any logs that I do now, if the request ID and the user ID are available on the context, they're attached to that log.
Cool.
Which has turned out to be like so helpful, because finally, after years, I'm able to, when a user says, oh, I'm having a hard time, I can say, what's their user ID? Now I can look at the logs for that user and actually see what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just cannot believe it has taken me this long to get to this point in my life. Like, I feel like I should have had this from the beginning years ago. But that was a huge success story for me. So I'm a big fan of Datadog so far, and also a big fan of appropriate use of global state.
Mm-hmm.
Where that helps, because it has been very helpful.
That's cool.
So that was my adventure this week. Any questions about, was that way too much detail?
No, I think that was cool. I'm interested to look into CLS Hooked. Do you have any code you want to dump in relation to that?
Yes. Yeah, I'll dump that up in a gist as well. It won't be very... The problem is the other two files are really easy to just... They're isolated, basically. They could just put them up and be understood. The CLS Hooked thing is kind of spread across two or three files.
Right. Okay.
So I would actually... And maybe I won't put that up. Just go look up CLS Hooked. It takes a little bit of figuring to figure out, because it's a paradigm shift, because all of a sudden you're like, wait, where is the state available and where is it not? But once it's experimented,
okay,
the documentation's pretty good and
cool.
Yeah, it makes sense after a bit.
All right.
But yeah, that was super valuable. So I'm a big fan of that.
That's fun.
So far I'm still okay with Node, Node as my server, and things are plugging along.
Reasons compiling to it.
I'm happy with that. I'd still like the runtime situation to be figured out, so I don't have to ship like a massive OCaml binary out
on
servers.
Yeah.
Because that's not even necessary, you know, once the compiler happens. But since I'm shipping with Docker, it's okay.
And cool.
So we'll figure that out at some point.
All right. Well, that was a fascinating story.
And that was a long show. Sorry, everybody, but I'm glad you got to hear it. I think it's actually, we've been over an hour now.
Okay.
So let's wrap it up.
Thanks
for listening, Jared. So everybody, we want to talk to you a little bit quickly about transcription, because there are lots of people who can use their ears to listen to podcasts, and there are also lots of people who can't. There are lots of people whose ears don't work properly, but they still want this information. So it costs a lot of money to provide translations, though I have recently become aware of a way, not translation, sorry,
transcriptions.
I've recently become aware of a way to provide transcriptions for about $5 for every 30 minutes. There are people on this website, Fiverr, who will do it for that much. So on average, a show would cost about $20 for us to transcribe, maybe $25 if we go over like we did today.
Mm-hmm.
So we're looking to the community for support. If those of you have a few dollars to spare who are willing to provide transcriptions to those who can't use their ears, we'd really appreciate it. And there is a link in the show notes. So this is a new thing. There's also a podcasting platform we're looking at called Anchor, and they provide a way for us to receive donations. It's very easy. If you click that link in the show notes, it should pop up a web page on your phone, and you should be able to pay with Apple Pay or Google Wallet or a custom credit card, and it'll give you three ways to donate, 99 cents a month, $5 a month, or I think $10 a month. And so they take some cut of that. We get most of it. If we get enough people donating every month, we try to put about two shows a month.
Mm-hmm.
So let's work out the math. If it's about two shows a month and about $25 a show, then we need about $50 a month or so to be able to provide transcriptions regularly. So if you're willing to help out with that, we would really appreciate it. And we'd love for you to jump on and donate some money so that we can start getting these transcribed for people.
Yeah. And if you're already on Patreon and you want to go through Patreon to help out with donation, that'll also work. We'll put the Patreon link in the show notes as well.
Yes, we will. And thank you to the listeners who are still donating on Patreon. We really appreciate it. Thank you for supporting us. And we'll be looking more into that. Outside of that, reach out to us on Twitter. Reasontown FM is the show's handle. I'm Mr. Murphy Tweets. I just changed my account name. And Jared is Jared Lee on Twitter.
At Jared Forsyth.
Oh, Jared Forsyth. Jared Lee is your GitHub?
That's right.
Yeah. Sorry. At Jared Forsyth. So you can reach out to us individually if you like. And if you have a minute, feel free to rate us on iTunes. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
Until next time.